So the irony is that we just had you talk precisely when we needed to test the audio and couldn't hear it. But you wouldn't know it to look at us, but we've been teaching this course for 11 years. Maybe the 12th time will be the charm here. So welcome to Computer Science E1. My name is David Malin.
I'm Dan Armendaris.
And this is about understanding computers and the internet. Before we dive in today, let me offer you a little bit of comfort. And we know firsthand from having chatted with one or more of you out in the lobby before, there's probably among the 100 plus students that have registered for this course, both on campus and off campus, a number of you who are a little uncomfortable with being in this course, or at least being with your own computer. Odds are, statistically, all of you own a computer, use a computer, some right now, in the classroom, and that's pretty typical these days. But when something goes wrong with that computer, you don't necessarily know what to do. You maybe know who to call, but you don't necessarily know how to fix it yourself. Or if you're chatting by the water cooler with some of the more technical folks at work, it just kind of is all over your head. And from the smiles and some of the head nods, I feel like we're chipping away already here. And let me say this. So this course is designed for a fairly broad demographic, for the students who use a computer every day, but who would consider themselves uncomfortable or among those less comfortable. The course is all about giving you a sense of confidence so that when you exit this course, you don't necessarily know everything. We probably can't turn you from 0 to 100 miles per hour over the course of just 3 or 4 months, but you'll exit with more confidence. You'll know where to look for more information. You'll know what kinds of questions to ask, and you'll appreciate what you do and don't understand, and better yet, you'll hopefully appreciate what the salespeople you encounter henceforth in your lives do and don't know. So that's one of the goals of this course. But before we dive into some actual content, we thought it would be a bit apropos this week, given all of the hype surrounding Apple Computer's supposed release of a brand new fancy device, just released their earnings report, and no one seems to be immune to the hype around Apple. We thought we would indulge and give you a little sneak peek as to what it appears they have been working on. So I offer you this, our first video.
The tech world is buzzing over Apple's latest must-have gadget, the MacBook Wheel, a revolutionary new laptop that does away with the keyboard. TechTrends reporter Jeff Tate has more.
Thanks, Andrea. Say goodbye to the keyboard and hello to the future of laptop computers. With the MacBook Wheel, Apple has replaced the traditional keyboard with a sleek, touch-sensitive click wheel. Apple CEO Steve Jobs introduced the product yesterday at the annual Mac Expo. Senior product innovator Brian Gilman says the MacBook Wheel will make typing a thing of the past.
At Apple, our philosophy is create products that are simple to use, and nothing's more simple than a single giant button.
Gilman showed me how the revolutionary new computer works.
Just open the Intuitype alphabet menu here, scroll to the letter you need, see, and center click to select it. Then click again to capitalize, and repeat this process for each new letter. It couldn't be simpler. You can also let the predictive sentence technology complete the sentence for you.
Gilman says the MacBook Wheel has also simplified the organization of files, so searching your hard drive will be a snap.
Just press both sides of the wheel concurrently and center click in there. You have an alphabetical listing of every file on your hard drive. Everything is just a few hundred clicks away.
Apple is calling the MacBook Wheel the most intuitive product ever designed.
Here at Apple, we like to think that we're giving customers features they don't even realize they want yet.
While the MacBook Wheel won't hit the shelves for another 3 to 15 months, many Apple users already have it on their wish list.
I'll buy almost anything that's shiny and made by Apple.
Alex Zalman was one of the lucky few to get to try out a Mac Wheel and spent 45 minutes typing an email to his friend.
I never really noticed how much I hated keyboards until I saw this thing. Mac had the email automatically says something from the MacBook Wheel. That way people know you have one.
With a price tag of just under $2,600 for the lowest end MacBook Wheel, it is an investment. But the super-thin laptop features numerous innovations like the new ultra-thin Hummingbird battery, which can power the MacBook Wheel for a full 19 minutes before needing to be recharged. And the computer is virtually unbreakable unless dropped or hit. But Apple isn't resting on its laurels. Brian Gilman said they are already hard at work on the next generation of the MacBook Wheel, which will be 4 ounces lighter due to its lack of screen hard drive or wheel. For the Apple News Network, I'm Jeff Tate.
Thank you for that, Jeff. It remains to be seen if the wheel will catch on in the business world where people use computers for actual work and not just dicking around. Moving on, police warn that the Sudoku killer will kill either one.
So they're probably in one of two camps at this point. Either you think this was real, or you know that it wasn't. And either way, by the end of the semester, you will know that this was not, in fact, real. Apple still has a little bit of announcing to do on Wednesday. But this is a hilarious, we think, spoof that's gone around from the Onion Network for some time. So there are, again, these two camps in the course. One, the students who are less comfortable, who need to exit this course hopefully with a bit of empowerment, a bit more of a sense of savvy when it comes to using computers, and then those of you who actually feel yourselves pretty sophisticated, and you wouldn't think yourself in an introductory computer science class, since you use computers every day, you know how to talk the talk, and you read the trade rags and such, but there's some holes in your knowledge. You might not necessarily know how DHCP actually works, even though you use it every day. You might not know how DNS traffic gets from point A to point B, and so that's the other aspect of the course, is to fill in those holes so that hopefully there's a little bit of something for everyone in this course.
And certainly, we're going to start it off today with a lot of really exciting things. As you can see, we brought in quite a bit of hardware that we're going to show you, which is representative, maybe not of exactly the type of computer that you're using, since this is old and we let it get rained on, so it obviously doesn't work anymore. But we'll at least give you an idea of what you're looking at, rather than just this weird mass of cables and green boards that are in your computer. And I mean, starting in about 30 seconds from whenever I stop saying this incredibly long sentence, we're going to start diving into some really interesting things involving how a computer actually functions, calculates, and computes.
So then, to set the stage, we have a little cartoon for you. So how many of you find this funny yet? And how many of you are just laughing awkwardly because you don't know? Okay, so from the few chuckles, seems like we're still here, which is good, because that means we can do a little something on the board here. So let's see if we can't at least have you exit this room knowing a bit about how a computer actually speaks. So even if you have no clue how a computer works and it's underneath the hood, you probably have some vague sense that it all somehow boils down to zeros and ones. So zeros and ones is known as the what system, if you've heard the jargon. Yeah, the binary system. So bi meaning two, like a bicycle has two wheels. So binary system is one in which you can only express yourself using zeros and ones. This is in contrast with the decimal system, which we typically use, which gives you 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Decimal meaning dec for 10. So that's the world we typically live in. But computers only understand zeros and ones, and yet they're able to do amazing things. You can play music, watch videos, type essays, and all of this. So where does that all derive from? Well, think back to grade school for just a moment. And you may recall that way back in the day, when you learned about arithmetic and such, your teacher might have written down a very trivial number, 1, 2, 3, and total softball question, what number is this in normal person speak? 123. Okay, but why is that? Well, you think back to how we actually assign values to these columns. So this was the so-called ones column over here. This was the so tens column, right? It all comes back very quickly. And this is the hundreds column. So how do we get from 1, 2, 3 to the value we know as 123? Well, let's see. We have 3 ones. So that's 3 times 1. That's 3. 2 tens. So that's 20. So that's 20 plus 3 is 23. And then 1 100. So that's 100 plus 20 plus 3. 123. All right, so we haven't really made all that much progress, but it turns out that binary is exactly the same thing, except you can't write down twos and threes and fours and everything. You can only write down zeros and ones. So if I wanted to express, we won't start this big, but if I wanted to express the number 0 in binary, and you only have the digits 0 and 1 to work with, what's it going to be?
0.
All right, so another softball question. So the number we know as 0 is going to be, actually, it's kind of stupid to quote it. Why don't I write it out in English? So the number we know to be 0 in binary is going to be just 0. All right, what is going to be, another softball question, the number we know as 1? All right, 1. But now we got a problem, because we're kind of out of digits. Now here, normal people would go on to 2 and 3 and 4, but we can't do that. But can we leverage this kind of system? Well, I'm going to give you I'll spoil the answer and see if we can't derive the origin. At this point in the story, if I were counting in the real world from 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, damn, same situation. I'm out of digits. I hit 9. What do I do then next in the real world? Yeah, so a new column, right? You sort of carry over to the next column, so now we need 2 digits. So the key here is going to be we need something and something. We can start to grow to the 2-digit space. So the answer is actually going to be 10, I claim. That represents the number 2. Now, why is that? Well, what does this rightmost column represent and this leftmost column represent now? You can kind of... So 0 and 2, the value indeed is 0. So if we now look at this as, and let me tweak my own numbers here. I'm going to move this over here, and I'm going to move this over here, just so things start to align properly. So now you call this the zero. It's not the zeros column, though. What should this rightmost column probably be? So the ones column. It has to be the ones column, otherwise the system would have broken down already. All right, so what's this column probably represent? All right, so this is the twos column, and let's do a sanity check. All right, so I have zero ones, zero, a one, two, so that indeed gives me the number two. And now three should be pretty easy. Three is gonna be, yeah, one, one. And now let's take it one step further, and don't shout out just yet. Let me give you 5 seconds, and if you could, humor us by coming up in your head with the answer to what the value four is going to be. Take a few seconds. All right, and someone who doesn't think their answer is right, what is it? Go out on a limb here. What's that? 101, close, so close. Not 101, but 100. So 100, we would say in decimal, but 100. And why is that? Well, here's the ones column. Here's the twos column. Now, you might have thought this would be the threes column, and that's a reasonable guess, but we'll come back to this in a moment. This is indeed the ones, twos, fours column. So we have zero ones, zero twos, and 1 4, which means I have the value four. And now just let's do one more before this gets tedious. Five is going to be, as was offered a second ago, 101. For the same reason, a one in the ones column, a zero in the twos column, and a one in the fours column. So now why is it 1 2 4 and not 1 2 3? Well, it's the same idea over here. And not to overwhelm with math, because almost everything we do in this class will be devoid of math. But we're going to start from the basic building blocks here tonight. This is actually 10 to the zeros column. This is 10 to the ones column. This is 10 to the twos column. And if you remember your powers, 10 to the 0 is 1, 10 to the 1 is 10, 10 to the 2 is 100. So it's just another way of expressing what we called in grade school the ones column, the tens column, the hundreds column. So if we apply that same logic here now, what we're calling the ones column, the twos column, and the fours column is equivalently, if I'm not writing too low, 2 to the 0, 2 to the 1, 2 to the 2. 1, 2, 4. So what's the next column going to be if we actually continue this out? Yeah, 8 and then 16 and then 32, 64, 128, 256, 512, 1024. Oh, we forgot 2048, 4096. I'm going to win. This is fun for like four people in the room right now. 8192, and then Dan?
I don't know. 16,536.
Excellent. So now turn your attention back to this Foxtrot cartoon. Now do you chuckle a little bit? All right. Ah, okay, perfect. We have accomplished something. So the joke ultimately derives from this. When the kid says 100, no, that's actually the binary number of 4. So we actually have one other cartoon here, which I thought we would do together. So this one's a little bit heavier. All right, so first, it's kind of clever at the right-hand side. The brother is saying alpha bits, and then the kid is saying, no, alpha bytes. So let's tease this apart, because here's a bit of jargon. And please, at any point during this lecture, the next lecture, any of the lectures, if we ever, either of us, use any piece of jargon, an acronym, or whatever that we have not defined, or we did define, but you forgot 5 seconds ago, totally fine. Raise your hand, ask the person next to you. There's no sense getting tripped up on what ultimately is meaningless details like jargon and acronyms. So let's pluck off the first piece of jargon. So what is a bit? Yeah.
One or a zero.
Oh, that's it. So a bit is a one or a zero. So when a moment ago we said that in the binary system we have zeros and one or two digits, well, someone pointed out very cleverly back in the day, oh, that's like a binary digit or a bit. And thus was born the word bit. So it just means a zero or a one. That's it. All right, when you have a byte though, what is a byte? Since this is a bit more of a popular term these days. 8 bits, that's it. So the world early on realized, wow, you really can't do all that much interesting stuff with just a single bit, a zero or a one. You can do a lot more, 8 times as many things with 8 bits. actually even more than that, but let's call that with a more interesting unit of measure, the byte. So a byte is just a made-up word that describes 8 bits. And computers typically operate in units of 8, or in powers of 2. So you'll see some recurring themes, some recurring numbers, both in the class and also on those price tags at Best Buy and descriptions and computer catalogs. So let's take one step up from that, just to continue with Dan's chart here. Byte is also pretty small. You can't listen to much music if it's just 8 bits long. It doesn't last very long. So what typically comes after a byte? What unit of measure? OK, so a kilobyte. So a kilobyte, kilo, typically meaning 1,000. Bit misleading here because a kilobyte, typically in the computer world, doesn't mean 1,000 bits, but instead how many bits? And not 8, but little louder? 1,024. So the computer world, for various reasons, some of which we'll tease apart over the course of the semester, likes powers of 2. And again, not to overwhelm with math, but 2 to the power of 10 is 1,024, and that's where we got that number from. So when you say kilobyte, that means 1,024 bytes. All right, so still in the realm of not so useful, right? A typical Microsoft Word document that you might write these days, that might be a few kilobytes because it's a few hundred or a few thousand characters, but almost everything you download these days uses what unit of measure? Yeah, so megabytes. You download an MP3, a music file, and that's typically 3 megabytes, 5 megabytes, maybe even 10. So mega, typically denoting million, typically means 1 million bytes. But that too is a bit of a white lie. It's a bit more than a million. But at this point, if we actually start doing out the math, it quickly becomes tedious. So mega is essentially a million. All right, what comes after mega? Okay, gigabyte. So I saw a couple of folks kind of shrug, you don't know, but you've probably heard it. And that'll be one of the eye openers here. So gigabyte, giga meaning billion, so that means a billion bytes. So now let's contextualize this. Before we just start rattling off jargon for jargon's sake, some things we measure in these units. So binary and bits, rather. It's 0 or 1. There's not much you can do with just a 0 or 1. Even a byte, not that useful these days. Kilobyte, Microsoft Word file. A few kilobytes is reasonable there. I just rattled off MP3, like a music file that you might download from iTunes or the like. Might be in this realm, megabytes. What about gigabytes? What might you measure in terms of gigabytes? OK, so videos. So videos these days might very well be 1 gigabyte, 2 gigabytes. And that's a video you might download from iTunes. Might be a video you download on demand via Comcast, even though your cable box doesn't tell you usually how much data you're downloading. If it's a nice HD video, the high-end, high-fidelity videos, that's several gigabytes often. What else comes in gigs? Programs. Things you've heard of. Sorry? So programs, when you buy a program and install it, it typically comes on a DVD. And we'll talk more about DVDs and such next week. But a DVD holds multiple gigabytes. And what's the biggest thing in your hard drive where you put everything? What's the device called in a hard drive? Damn. OK, roll back. A hard drive is where you store all of your data. And if you buy a hard drive, some of you might just call this your memory. But we'll come up with more finely defined terms for these things. Your hard drive is typically 100 gigabytes, 500 gigabytes. Or if you're a bit more of the geek, like Dan and me, I just bought a pair of 2 terabyte hard drives. So that's a good segue to terabyte. So when you get to terabyte, now you're talking trillions of bytes. And that might kind of blow your mind. But it's really not all that unreasonable. I was actually fascinated to discover that I have it currently in my home, a 1 terabyte hard drive. And that sounded huge, honestly, a couple of years ago. It didn't even exist a few years before that. But I noticed the other day, wow, I'm using almost all of this space already because it's not my Microsoft Word files. It's not essays and things and emails I've sent. It's what that's starting to eat up all my space?
Music
and videos especially. You download a video. Ironically, you download this video that we are filming right now a couple days from now, and you're going to download 0.5 gigabyte, 500 megabytes of Dan and me talking. And that starts to eat up space quickly. And just to put that into context so that you realize that the stuff is not so arcane here but is pretty familiar, an iPod or an iPhone typically only has 16 gigabytes, maybe 32 gigabytes. So 32 gigabytes, 500 megabytes is 0.5 gig, so that means I can only store 64 lectures on here. Now that's more lectures than we'll actually have in the course, but very quickly do these numbers start to consume your valuable disk space and the money you've spent on this thing. And so the fascinating thing about teaching this course for some 11 years is that the fundamentals have really stayed the same. There's so many new toys out there and such, but it's really going to reduce to some of these basic building blocks, but it's the numbers. We have to keep ratcheting up in the course. More RAM, more hard disk space, more CPU cycles, all of the stuff we'll talk about today.
And in fact, to put this into more context, so how many of you know what it is that I am holding? So yes, so what is it? It's a floppy, so yeah, it's a floppy diskette. And do you remember how much capacity these ancient things hold? 3.5 what? No, too much. 1.44 megabytes. So we're talking now about terabytes. David just broke the bank buying 2 terabyte hard drives. We're talking about gigabytes that you find in your iPods and your iPhones that can fit in your pocket. But just a few years ago, we could only fit orders of magnitude less in the megabytes. So we would need almost 500 of these diskettes to hold the video that we are recording right now. So just to put it into perspective. So luckily, these are now becoming very, very ancient, which is good. But it does, I think, provide some useful context for the capacity and just how quickly we are growing in terms of the technology.
And not to conflate your childhood with mine, but I remember growing up with a Mac SE, which was one of these beige-colored Macintoshes, sat on your desk. I used it for all of my essays in high school and maybe even tail end of middle school. And yet, I still remember to this day, and I'm enough of a pack rat that I still have all of these floppy disks in my mom's house. I still remember I would back up, like a good computer user, my hard drive, which I think was like 20 megabytes at the time. It was huge for hard drives those days. But to back this thing up, I had a little plastic carrying case of like 40 of these things that, like an idiot, I would sit there for an hour, put this in, the thing would do its thing, copy 1.44 megabytes onto this, I would eject it, put it aside, label it, put the next one. I mean, this was not actually all that long ago. So it's fascinating how quickly things have progressed. So, but this is also to say that rest assured that when you exit this course, the knowledge you derive will not be it will be dated numerically, but not so much fundamentally. And you should appreciate that over the course of the term. So we have this one joke here to reason through still. So it's a lot of binary. And the joke here is that these aren't alpha bits. They're alpha bytes, because notice that the cartoonist wrote 8 bits in sequence. And that's all that means. So again, a byte is 8 bits. And what does that mean in real terms? Well, it just means you write out the bits back to back to back. This is not a byte, because I only have 2 bits. But in fact, if I wanted to express the number, let's say 3, which is just 1, 1, as a byte, well, it's still 1, 1. But I just have to fill in the blank with 6 of these things. So now I have a byte, which still represents the number 3. Same thing in decimal system. If I say this is the number 123, well, you know what? So is that. You know what? So is that. So is that. It's uninteresting to have these leading zeros. But that's how you can pad it, so to speak, to actually have a complete byte. So unfortunately, fortunately for us, there's actually a hidden message inside of this cartoon. The humor doesn't stop at just alpha bits and alpha bytes. It turns out that this soup is actually expressing a fairly witty phrase here. So this begs the question, how can you encode a phrase, like an English phrase, if all you have are these zeros and ones? Clearly, we can represent numbers that we're familiar with, but you and I also converse constantly using A and B and C and D all the way through Z, at least in this alphabet, to actually communicate even more effectively. So hopefully, computers have made the leap from zeros and ones, not just to numbers, but to alphabetical characters. And in fact, they have. So there is this system known as ASCII. So this is a crazy sounding acronym. American Standard Code for Information Interchange is, I think, what it stands for. Uninteresting for our purposes. It is simply a mapping from numbers to letters. And in fact, there's way more detail in this slide than you actually need. But I took it from, frankly, my favorite website for just quickly looking these things up. This is from ASCIITable.com. ASCIITable.com. And I brought it up here just because it's a useful reference if you ever have to figure something like this out. And you won't for a while, but toward the tail end of the course, and we'll tease you with some of this detail later today, we'll look at HTML. And you'll actually implement your own web pages. And some of these same codes might prove useful then as well. But take a look in this middle column. Try to ignore the distraction. If this looks like Greek to you now, good. It will not, 3 to 4 months hence. But take a look on the right-hand side in red. So there's the at sign and then A, B, C, D. OK, so there's the letters. And now there's a few different columns here, but let's only look for the moment at the left-hand column, the DEC column, the decimal numbers. What number apparently corresponds to the letter A? in this ASCII code scheme? 65. Yeah. So actually, just 65. 65. And then, as an aside, the next column is called hexadecimal, octal, HTML. We'll touch upon some of those over the course of the semester. But for now, take it away just this. With zeros and ones, can we represent numbers larger than one? And using multiple bits, bytes worth of bits, can we actually represent letters? So what's interesting about ASCII is that it uses 8 bits, a byte. Small white light usually uses 7, but it essentially uses 1 byte, 8 bits, to represent letters in a standard way. So when you first turn on your computer, at least years ago, when you first turned on your PC, you didn't get fancy graphics. Usually you'd get like a black or a green screen and a whole lot of text. And there would be some words up here, some more words. It would maybe tell you that it's checking your RAM or your memory, stuff like that. But very basic text, no fancy fonts or anything like that. Well, how did your computer do that? Well, it simply loaded into its memory, another technology we'll tease apart today, patterns of bits. The first pattern, if it wanted to say hello to you, it would first load into its memory the number 72. It would load it in terms of zeros and ones, but ultimately it would load the number 72 into memory. And what would it load into memory after 72? 69, because the goal is to say hello, H-E-L-L-O on the screen. We can still, how about L? What comes there? 76, 76, 79. And those 5 bytes for H-E-L-L-O would be enough to tell the computer, oh, as soon as you see these numbers inside of your memory, and again, more on memory later today, display H-E-L-L-O on the screen. So now we have this ability to quantize information. It's just zeros and ones, tiny little pieces of information. We can step up to bigger numbers, and then we can step up to English characters just by using this basic system. So ASCII is a code in that it's just a big chart, a big cheat sheet that maps numbers to letters, letters to number. So now let's figure out why this joke is funny to some people. I don't think it's a fun exercise to do all of the math to figure out what each of those numbers represents. So I did some Googling, and I found this very useful website. We'll link to this on the course's website ultimately, but this is just a website that some nice person implemented using a programming language that lets me type in some binary, and it's going to convert the binary to the corresponding number for me and then to the corresponding letter. So it's going to do all the math for us so we don't have to waste time with chalk on the board. So let me go ahead and try to move this onto the screen all at once. So it looks like we have how many letters in this cartoon? Yeah, so 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So we have 7 bytes of bits on the screen. So let's do the top left first. Go ahead. Could someone read it out to me?
0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 0.
Okay, so let me pause for a second, enlarge my window, and I'm going to click this decode button, and it looks like the first letter is a Y. So, no pun intended, why is that? Well, what must this letter actually represent? Let me go back to ASCIITable.com. And let's do a little sanity check here. It's saying that it should be a Y. So if I scroll down to the Y portion and zoom in, what must that pattern of bits be representing that I just typed in?
89.
The number 89. That's it. So we won't go back and forth so much because the numbers, and certainly don't memorize any of these numbers except maybe like 65A. Turns out you can figure out all of the others from just that one. So that's a useful one to know. Let's go back to this and finish typing in the pattern and see what the comic wanted us to know. So there we go. So I'll rattle these off. 0, 1, 0, 0, 1, 1, 1, 1 is the top right. Now I'm going to go for the top middle. So 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 1. Okay, next one is 0, 1, 0, 0, 1, 1, 1, 0. And now, just to follow along, I'm on the third row all the way on the right. 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 1. Now the bottom row. 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 0, 1, 0. Finally, 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 0. And if I made no mistakes, let's zoom in on this. I'm going to go ahead and click decode and. So, a little ASCII humor for you. It indeed spells out "you nerd" for the people out there reading the Sunday paper who took the time to actually decode that. So, let's pause for just a moment to take any questions.
So, on your computer, it always separates it into 8 chunks of 8 binary, always separates binaries.
Correct. Computers, for reasons of convenience, because 8 bits is so much more useful than a single bit, almost always deal with numbers in units of 8. But with that said, if you've ever heard, somewhat arcanely, that your CPU, your computer's brains, are 32-bit, have you ever heard this phrase? Even Intel rattles these numbers off. Or the newest computers are 64-bit. They don't use 8 bits or single bytes. They use 4 bytes, because 4 times 8 is 32, hence 32-bit, or 8 bytes. 8 times 8 is 64 bits. But ultimately, it's units of 8. Other questions?
You know, an interesting takeaway from this, you'll notice that we had 7 sets of bytes, which means that we had, you know, a lot of numbers that we had to deal with. But usually, whenever TV shows or comedy shows try to make a joke about binary, they're always saying, oh, 1011. Then the other person goes, ah, ha, ha, like, that's so funny. There's no way that with only 4 binary numbers or with 4 bits, you'll be able to actually represent anything meaningful or even that funny. So it's usually they're just taking a lot of creative. And we'll see. This is, David and I have a lot of pet peeves about technology and movies and TV shows. And we'll try to, oh man, the worst one though. Okay, image enhancements, that gets me every time. But anyway, we'll try to debunk some of these things for you along the way as well. And so hopefully we'll be able to make you be slightly more annoying in movies and be like, oh, come on, that can't really happen.
So, anyway. So with that tirade aside, more questions.
What would be the advantage of having 32-bit or
64-bit? Oh, good question. So, and for the cameras, what would be the advantage of going 32-bit versus 64-bit? So even if you are not at all an engineer, can anyone here hypothesize why a 64-bit CPU, brains of a computer, might be better than 32-bit?
Speed.
Speed, but why? Yeah, more data at once. It's as though, what might be a good analogy here? A CPU that is 64-bit can literally consume twice as many bits at once, which means it can, it's a bit of an oversimplification, do work on numbers that are twice as large, really big numbers, which is increasingly necessary as we have terabytes of information in all of this. Or mathematically, it can do even more computations at once because it has this this wider data path.
It's the same sort of thing like called. You just did, where instead of typing in one byte at a time from this cartoon, you typed in multiple bytes, so a longer string, just to get it all over with at the same time. It's again, an oversimplification, but it's the same sort of thing because you're able to process that much more data, you can do it in bigger chunks.
And you know what a good analogy is? Not to harp too much on grade school. So a grade school teacher might take attendance, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So that's the 1-bit teacher. Well, the 2-bit teacher would be 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12. It's twice as fast. So 32 versus 64. That's a decent analogy, I'd say, too. Yeah. Good question. What does it mean to rewrite software for 64-bit CPUs? So without spoiling our programming lecture a few weeks hence, that generally means that you minimally take your programming code, as we'll see later. When you're a programmer, you do not write zeros and ones. There are English-like languages to express yourself, and we'll see some of that in a few weeks' time. When you want to convert your code from 32-bit to 64-bit, that typically means you minimally need to take what you wrote and run it through a more modern program called a compiler that simply spits out the newer version of the zeros and ones. But more on that in a few weeks' time or after class if you'd like. Other questions? All right, so I'm just itching to tear this thing apart. So we've thus far kept things very conceptual. So that's all fine and good if computers can deal with zeros and ones and then decimal numbers even and via ASCII alphabetical characters. But how do you actually store that on any form of medium? So we can't store much at all. We can store like a third of your favorite song on this floppy disk today. But it's representative of the more modern hardware. Inside of your computers are no longer floppy disks, but what device that I spoiled the answer to a little bit ago? Hard drives. So hard drives, as we'll see, actually are pretty functionally similar to this. They're faster, they're stronger, they store way more data, but functionally they're pretty much the same. Do you want to cue up our little camera for just a second?
Got to switch me over, sure.
Yeah. So let me, actually before we do that, let me go ahead and first spoil what's inside of a typical floppy drive. And we'll use this just as representative of your own modern hard drive. So we got a little bit of a video here. You may recall that floppy drives are typically in your desktop computers, or they might be external, connected to a laptop or something like that. But at the end of the day, they're little plastic things that take these things as input. So let's see if we can't see inside this disk without having to take it apart.
The floppy drive you see here works with 3.5-inch floppy disks. They're the type most often used to carry new programs, save data, or to move files from one PC to another. The part of the disk we see is actually just the hard plastic shell. The working disk, which is inside, is protected by a sliding metal shutter. This thin inner disk, called the cookie, is coated not with chocolate chips, but with a very thin layer of magnetic material. When you slip the disk into your floppy drive, a system of levers pushes back the metal shutter. The levers also pinch two read-write heads closer so they almost touch the cookie. A motor at the base of the drive spins the cookie based on commands from your PC. The PC also signals another motor to move the read-write heads back and forth over the surface of the disk so they can read or write data. Before your PC writes data, your drive first checks the Write Protect tab in the corner of the floppy disk. If it is open, light from a tiny diode shines through and strikes a diode on the other side. This diode then says to your PC,
"Don't write on this disk."
But if the tab is closed, no light gets through, and the PC knows it's okay to write data.
So if you're worried that things are starting already to get a little bit technical, quick recap. So inside of this floppy disk, which itself is not very floppy, it's pretty hard plastic, is behind this metal shutter, is a material that's apparently magnetic. It's the thing called a cookie, though frankly, I'd never heard it called a cookie until I watched this video. It apparently has some kinds of magnetic particles on it, but for now, take this as the takeaway. If you ever wondered what this, how this little lock tab worked, you probably didn't wonder how it worked. You just took for granted. But frankly, the fact that such a stupid, simple, 1 cent mechanism can do something so interesting, I think is testament to the fact that what you might right now feel is completely over your head or just completely foreign to you, sometimes really does reduce to very simple engineering principles or just frankly common sense. So let's take a little closer look now at what's onside this, on top of this magnetic platter, and then we'll turn things over to Dan to actually take this thing apart. Part 2 of 2.
To write data onto a floppy disk, your PC tells the drive to send tiny pulses of electricity through the heads. The pulses make the heads act like little electromagnets. Each head creates a magnetic field that reaches the surface of the disk. Remember the magnetic coating on the cookie? The magnetic field alters the tiny particles in this coating. If current runs through the heads one way, the particles are arranged with their north and south poles in one direction. But if current flows through the heads the opposite way, the polarity reverses. To read data from a disk, the read-write heads move into the same position over the cookie, but this time the process is reversed. The cookie particles create a magnetic field in the coils of wire, and this creates a current in the read-write heads. The disk drive detects this flow of electricity and passes it onto the PC. The PC translates the back and forth current changes into a series of ones and zeros. The binary language of computer data.
So, quick recap, you can't see them, and if you touch them with your finger, you won't feel them, though you will be pushing them off and making a mess of the data on the disk, but there's a whole bunch of magnetic particles, and if you align it like this, it represents a zero. Maybe a one, but let's just call it a zero. But if you flip it, it represents the opposite, a one instead of a zero, or a zero instead of a one.
And an interesting takeaway from this is it ties back into this discussion of binary, that there's a reason that everything in computers is represented with a zero or a one. It's because it's very easy to create a number of devices that can detect, you know, if it's in one state, it's a zero. If it's in another state, it's a one. And so it's easy to be able to store data, to be able to recall data. And even though we have diskettes that use one particular method of storing data, we also have hard drives that store data. We also have memory, so, you know, little sticks of memory that store data as well. And all of these are just slightly different, but the end result is the same. They all communicate with the computer or store their data in this language of ones and zeros. So on the screen right now, we have just a small diskette that says very nicely, Windows 98 SE OEM boot disk. So how many of you remember the days of Windows 98? Well, for those of you that do, this might actually give you great pleasure because I'm about to destroy this disk. And so, one of the things you'll notice that, again, we have, just like we saw in the movie and just like David reiterated, we have this little metal sheet that can be moved to be able to show the diskette on the inside, and then also this little plastic tab that blocks this light from the diode to be able to tell the computer whether or not to write the data. Now, the great thing about these is that they're also really easy to take apart, so unfortunately I can't do it on that camera, but what I can do is you just grab the one metal piece and you just take it off. All right, that's done. And now we have something that looks a lot more like the original floppy diskette. So this is the diskette, which is the small 3.5-inch version with the hard plastic that's not really all that flexible. But the floppy got its name from those, you know, larger 5.25-inch diskettes, or disks rather, that actually were floppy, and the name just sort of carried over. And the principle is the same, it's just that the density on these is higher. In other words, you can store more ones and zeros in a smaller space. And density is very important to us, especially when we're talking about disks, or as we scale up even to hard disks, as we'll talk about in just a little while. All right, so getting to even the more interesting bit, you're able to just completely take apart the plastic, if you don't completely ruin it like I am. And you get on the inside just a floppy little section that is a disk. And it is actually very, very floppy. And I guarantee that any data that was on here is now destroyed just by my touching it. That's one reason why there's the metal sheet down there, so you don't accidentally touch the diskette inside. But, and like David said, you won't be able to see it even if we zoom in really, really close. But on here, there are small magnetic particles that are used to be able to communicate back to the computer ones and zeros. And this is an example of a type of memory that we can write to it and it will remember the contents that we wrote to it. Not all types of memory have the same attribute though, and we'll talk about this also in just a little bit. So as you see, everything builds upon everything else. There's a lot of teasers in here, so we try to make all of this as clear as possible.
So we were actually glad to find that Windows 98 disk, because the first one I proposed that we use to Dan was this one. Do you want to show why this would have been kind of a stupid exercise?
Yeah, well, I pointed out when we picked this out that, well, you can just see right through the disk anyway, so it was sort of pointless. And it's a lot more fun to destroy a diskette than just to look at it in sort of X-ray vision and say, oh, yeah, look at that, it's really cool. But the problem is that the other thing inside that you see in that diskette that you don't really see in this blue one is this white area right there. And that's just a little piece of, like, soft felt cloth that's used to clean the disk as it spins inside. And so it's actually protecting, I suppose, the actual dark disk that actually stores the data. You can sort of see it. I don't know if you can really see it, but you can sort of see its outline along the outside of this white soft felt edge.
So a quick recap, a little quiz, if you will. How much data can you store on a typical floppy?
1.44.
Yeah, I see some of you just gave me the number and not the unit. The unit's kind of important. Yeah, 1.44 megabytes. In MP3, a music file, we estimated is typically how large?
3 to 5.
Yeah, like 3 to 5 megabytes, can definitely vary, but that's a decent ballpark. I just bought a hard drive that stores how much data?
2 terabytes,
or 2 trillion bytes, or 16 trillion bits, if you do out the math by multiplying it by 8. So, little bit of trivia. Why don't we take a moment to take a look at the course itself, give you a sense of the arc of the course, where you're going to begin, where you're going to end, and what you will visit along the way. So the course is structured primarily along the lines of lectures and some at-home activities. So lectures are most Mondays throughout the term, same time, same place as you are here, though we will have, as is great fun, no matter the age group, movie nights a couple of times. We've gotten over the 11 years to be pretty buddy-buddy with a fellow named Johnny, who works at Kendall Square. You may have bought some popcorn or some cotton candy from this man. He's wonderfully sweet to us and offers us huge bags of popcorn twice a year. So we will use those for movie night 1 and movie night 2. And more on those in just a second. But let's give you a quick sense of some of the logistics here. So why don't we tease first with movie nights. So page 2 of the syllabus, which you should have in your hands. If not, you can grab it during a break, which we'll take in a little bit by the window there. We like to depict this picture from Dan's alma mater, which is MIT's famed hack, whereby some students connected a fire hydrant to a water fountain, and it worked. And the little sign that's actually cut off in this figure here says something like, getting an education from MIT is like drinking water from a fire hose. Which is to say, they hit you, as we will hit you, with a whole lot of information. There will be a lot of jargon, a lot of acronyms, a lot of technology, and your odds are not going to be able to swallow it all, certainly the first time you hear it, and maybe even over the course of several months, because some of this stuff takes time just to sink in. And frankly, as much as we throw at you, 4 months hence, there's going to be even more that you've never heard of, because we haven't heard of it yet either. But this is only to say that the point of the course is to expose you to as much information as possible, give you breadth across a whole range of topics, some of which we'll highlight in just a moment, and then also some depth in some select topics, but that ultimately, when you exit this course, so that you're empowered to go answer questions that might be outstanding in your mind, and again, you know where to turn to. So if you're thinking here tonight, wow, I don't even remember how to say the number 3 in binary, it's 1-1, that's okay, because hopefully you remember the number 0 and the number 1, and from there you can reverse engineer other answers and the like. So here is the structure of the course. And again, this is in your own handout there. So homework, there's 2 exams, which will be roughly halfway and toward the end of the semester. They'll be during lecture time here in this room, and then a final project. And the final project, as the little teaser, is going to involve your buying your own domain. So myfancydomainname.com. It will cost maybe like $6.99, $10, or if you're a bit vain and want like david.tv, it's going to run you $39.99, but I do not own that domain. So, most of the course's interaction will be both in person here during lectures, as well as accessible via the course's website. So computerscience1.net is the address of the course's website. There is very little there now except for a link to homework 1, or assignment 1, which will be due a week hence, and is linked there on the front page, and the course's syllabus. And as the semester progresses, more and more information will be up there. And perhaps most compellingly will there be, thanks to the 2 camera and camera crew here, videos of every one of the lectures. So if you aren't able to make some class on campus, that's fine. If you found us confusing or went too fast or went too slow, you can both fast forward and rewind through these videos and use them ultimately for review. And if you are so fancy, you can even download them to your iPhones and iPods and listen or watch us on your way to work, to each his own. Let's see. So, books for the course. There are no required books for this course. There's so much information, frankly, available online for free that they're really not necessary. But I think there's a lot of students out there, and we see this every year, who just enjoy the support structure provided by a book. Feels good. You're used to learning that way. So if you are the type who likes to have a course accompanied by some number of books, we would recommend these. And the top one there, called Computers Are Your Future. It's an awful title, but it's actually a pretty good book that we've used for several years. It's now out in 2 different editions. See the footnote as to which one to get. But it's a really good overview of the types of material covered by the course. The other books are a little more specialized. If you're the type who would really love to know how computers work inside beyond what we do tonight and next week, How Computers Work is a wonderfully visual and very user-friendly textbook that essentially on 2-page spreads gives you really beautiful pictures of what's inside of a computer and fairly succinct English descriptions of how it all work. So it's a nice accompaniment to this type of stuff we'll do in class. How the Internet Works does the same for this thing called the Internet, which we'll talk about in lectures 3 and 4. And then the last book is meant for the tail end of the course. It's a really nice reference book for making web pages. And we'll introduce you to as much as you need to know in the course. But again, if you like supplements, you might find these of interest. Let me suggest, they should be available in the Harvard Coop across the street. They will be available via Amazon.com and the like for much, much less money. So we encourage you, frankly, get them used, go online, or at least browse in the bookstore or in the library, but realize that this book, Computers Are Your Future, probably retails for like $100. We definitely don't expect such expenditures for information like this. So ask us questions if you have them about when it comes time to purchase. And then in a trajectory of the course, do you want to give an overview of what we're going to be doing beyond tonight?
Okay, sure. So as David alluded to, the first 2 lectures are devoted to hardware. As you've seen, we've already dealt and dove into some of the hardware that's available for a computer. We'll demystify some of the terminology and also a lot of the jargon that is associated with some of the hardware inside of your computer. And hopefully the end result will be that you'll be able to go into a store and you will know more than any old person that's just trying to sell you a computer. And that's certainly what we hope to be able to have you learn by the time you leave. Then we have a movie night instead of any sort of software lectures, Pirates of Silicon Valley, which is a really neat documentary style, but it's not a documentary. It's more of a drama based on real life events of how Apple and Microsoft got started and sort of the rivalry that happened between them and where all of this technology started and actually came from. Then starting lecture 3 and continuing until lecture 4, we're going to be talking about the interweb or the internet and demystifying a lot of the terminology for that and talking about how that works. What is DNS? What is DHCP? How can you connect to the internet? why when I say that I have Wi-Fi in my house, that isn't necessarily correct to say when you're talking about in terms of the hardware that you have available.
Because it's your neighbor that has Wi-Fi?
That's right. Piggybacking on everything. And anyway, demystifying a lot of that sort of, a lot of the aspects of the internet itself. Then we continue and talk about multimedia, including photos, videos, audio. We'll talk a bit. We're not going to go into a lot of detail about these particular types of formats because they can actually be pretty complicated in how they are made. But we will, of course, talk about this. Moving on to security, which actually seems to be very, very popular. A lot of people have a lot of questions, especially as it relates to internet security. How do I protect my passwords? How do I protect? We can't really help you protect your identity, but we can help give you tips for protecting yourself, your passwords, your identity online, and also protecting your computer from a variety of bad things, malware, viruses, worms, all of these sorts of weird, bad things that can happen to you or to your computer while you surf the internet, and also just some other security that can happen that's not related to the internet at all. You'd be surprised how much is actually related to just not being on the internet. It really is quite a varied topic that will be pretty interesting, I think. Then moving on to lecture 8, we'll talk about website development. So what David was talking about before, you'll actually be able to create and design your own website, not only for yourself, but for this class. Then we'll talk a little bit about some programming. So just some basic programming concepts. You're not going to be able to go home and write your own version of Windows or Mac OS, you know, once you hear this lecture, but it will get you started on some of the concepts, how we're actually able to apply these ones and zeros to do interesting things, to do one thing versus another, how we can make decisions on a computer. Then movie night will be regarding startup.com, which is actually a documentary about a business from the dot-com era that actually grew to be somewhat large, then they grew too quickly, and then you see what happens to them at the end of the dot-com era, after the big bust. And it's actually really interesting to see what happened to a technology company at that time. And then finally, lecture 10, our exciting conclusion, which I will save as a big special surprise.
Because
I don't even know what it is myself.
So Dan mentioned security and passwords, and the theme of the homework is actually going to revolve this semester a little bit about current events. So what you'll see, not for assignment one, which is really just a Q&A about you, a survey of sorts, so that we can get a sense of who's in the class, and so that a week hence we can actually share some details with you about who your classmates are, hopefully just dispel the misconception that everyone sitting around you knows more than you in this class. We'll give you some demographics and statistics. The assignments thereafter are going to be twofold. So we're going to have a computer science E1 blog, as these things are called, and a computer science E1 wiki. Now, these are two terms we'll tease apart over time, but a wiki is really just jargon for a website that normal people can edit without having to know HTML and JavaScript and all of these other languages that we will look at later in the semester, and you yourself will start to code. But a wiki is a website whereby you click a link, you log in, and then typing fairly straightforward letters and symbols, can you edit that website yourself without having to be a programmer, without having to know HTML. The theme of the wiki is going to be that Dan and I each week are going to put a number of placeholders. For instance, bit, byte, kilobyte, hard drive, floppy disk, and they will be blanks essentially for the class, 100 plus students collectively, to fill in the blanks and to define, much like Wikipedia, much like reference-based websites, in a few sentences, what is a bit, what is binary, what is SATA, what is ATA, what is AGP, all these things that right now don't know, that's good. But it'll be an opportunity for us to collaboratively to build up a corpus of information, and through collaboration and through some sanity checks on our part, we'll make sure that it is, in fact, all factually correct. And as the flip side to that, we'll have a focus again on current events, whereby each week you'll be tasked with plucking out from your favorite magazine, newspaper, or website that you've just been introduced to something techie that ideally a month ago you might not have had any idea what it was talking about, but now you'll start to notice some of those buzzwords, you'll start to notice some of those acronyms, and you realize, oh, that's what this article is talking about. And you might not understand all of it, but the goal will be for each of us to post to the course's blog, which is really just a fancy word for a website site where people post their thoughts, you'll post your own thoughts or reviews or summary of a current event like that, and it will be appropriately tagged so that you won't have to read 100 plus articles every week necessarily, but you'll be able to see what each other are discovering and also reinforce some of the material that we introduce in class. So more on that to come. But I thought I would kick things off with an article that was sent to me by multiple people this week because they know how we like to make fun of this topic later in the semester. This was an article published on January 21 in the New York Times. Thought I'd read a few sentences from it, but the title was, if your password is 123456, just make it hack me instead. So the article begins, back at the dawn of the web, the most popular account password was 12345. Today, it's one digit longer, but hardly safer, 123456. So despite all the reports of internet security breaches over the years, including the recent attacks on Google's email service, many people have reacted to the break-ins with a shrug. So this article was in part the result of a number of recent attacks, and we'll discuss things like this over the course of the semester, whereby like 32 million passwords for some website or some company were compromised, and so some researchers did an analysis and were just amazed by how many people's passwords were password, or were 123456 and such. What was funny though is I was looking for this article in my Gmail inbox this morning, and I searched for the only keyword I could remember, 123456, and what was funny, I had to redact some of the name information on this email here. But what was funny was this was an email from a class I taught a while ago where the individual needed some help submitting a project. We'll get it right. There we go. So I can get, hi, I know my project is late, but I keep getting errors when submitting. I can get into the site with terminal by typing in this command. My password is 123456. So apparently it is true, and I found this in my own inbox. And I didn't laugh at the time, and it's possible the fellow had changed it just to something silly so we would get it, but I think I'm being generous with that hypothesis there. So we'll talk about topics like these, but this is precisely the sort of stuff that will become more familiar, more accessible, and you'll understand, you know, what the trade-offs are with things like this. So why don't we go ahead and take a 5-minute break, grab a syllabus if you'd like. Bathrooms are upstairs, and we'll resume in 5 minutes. All right, so before break, we talked about how you would store zeros and ones and thus numbers and letters on a physical medium like a floppy disk, and next week we'll see a hard disk as well. But much of what goes on inside of your computer is not going on a floppy disk, and it's not even going on a hard disk. It's going on inside of that thing called the CPU, the so-called brains of your computer. So it turns out you can very cleverly, but very simply, represent these same building blocks, zeros and ones, with just electrical signals. So we used magnetic particles for the floppy, they used magnetic particles for hard drives, but for the computer itself, while it's running, for this so-called CPU inside, it's all just electrical current. And the way the world decided to represent a zero is by having, of course, slowly dimming lights, or not nearly as dramatic, you turn off the lights, you turn off the electricity, and your computer is storing a zero. Turn the electricity back on, and your computer is storing a very bright one, is storing a one. So you may have heard of these things called transistors, and people like Intel and technophiles like to brag how many tens of millions of transistors are being packed and tighter, ever increasingly on these things called CPUs these days. But a transistor, at the end of the day, is just a switch. It's either on or off, or open or closed, and that just means that electricity can either flow through it or not. It can either be representing a one or a zero. So electrically, can you represent these same building blocks? And that's pretty much then the basic building blocks of persistent storage on a floppy disk where it stays there even when the electricity is off or while the computer is running and flowing through your computer. So as you may have inferred from Dan standing here, we're about to take a little tour using our fancy new USB camera, USB being a buzzword we'll tease apart in a little bit, of this inside, what kind of computer is this? Do you want to remind us what's inside? I think
some Dell piece of junk from back in the day.
This did used to be in operation in the engineering school years ago.
It's going to take me a little while.
Ah, so it's the old beige type of computer. So let's see how what happens. You turn on your computer by pushing the switch, and electricity starts to flow through. What's the first thing you typically see on your screen? Your own screen. Okay, so some of you might see black and white text. Some of you might see a pretty little Dell icon or IBM icon. Some of you might see a happy Mac face. Right, it kind of varies, but what's typically happening when a computer starts up is what's called POST, power on self test. And you don't usually see this word anymore, it's sort of a yesteryear phrase, but POST, power on self test. The computer's doing a bunch of things to make sure everything is okay. So back in the day when you had a PC and you saw numbers counting from zero on up, it was checking your RAM, your memory, checking every byte to see, is this working okay? Well, that's a useful check, because if your RAM is not working, your memory, we'll look at this physically in just a moment, well, then you probably are not going to be very productive if the computer's malfunctioning. Computers will often check, is there a keyboard attached? If there's no keyboard, unless it's a server, probably not going to be very useful to you either. So there's a number of tests, power on self-tests, that get conducted, and this is one of the reasons why your computer boots sometimes somewhat slowly. Then what happens next? Well, the operating system gets loaded into memory. Some of you have Mac OS, some of you have Windows XP or 98 or 7 or Vista, any number of operating systems live on the hard drive, which again we'll look at in due time, but they are the essence of what you know as your computer when it boots up. So your computer knows how to turn on, how to check itself, but then it checks this device called the hard drive, loads all of those bits, all of those many megabytes and even gigabytes these days that Microsoft made and Apple made, and that's what starts to put the pretty pictures and the menus and the icons on your screen. Now in the meantime, once you're sitting there and your desktop is loaded and your cursor is blinking and your mouse is moving, well, there is stuff happening constantly inside this box. And the thing that's making all of that happen is this thing here. So this is a representative device called a motherboard or system board or logic board. These are all pretty much synonymous. Many of them are just green plastic. You might be more familiar with green circuit boards. This one's just a little prettier or uglier depending on your view. It's a little brown. But this is a motherboard, and you can think of this as the central artery system of your computer. And by that I mean any data that needs to go from point A to B in your computer pretty much has to travel through this motherboard. It's what connects your monitor to your keyboard to your mouse to the hard drive. It provides all of those interconnections so that what you have is a coherent whole device. Now, the brains of the computer sit on top of or attached to this device. And the brains of your computer is this thing called a CPU. So all of those zeros and ones that represent music, all of those zeros and ones that represent Microsoft Word or some favorite application of yours, ultimately have to flow through the CPU, because it's the CPU who's ultimately in charge of your computer. It's the CPU that understands all of these crazy patterns of zeros and ones that Microsoft made or Apple made or any number of companies out there, and realizes, oh, this pattern of ones and zeros means display the letter A. This means display the letter B. This means play the following sound. So it certainly gets more complicated than just A's and B's, but it's the CPU that must understand all of this. But meanwhile, while you're computer is running, it's not your hard disk that's being as actively used, it's what's called RAM. So RAM is your computer's memory, and this is a type of memory that people often conflate with their hard disk. There are, small white lie for just a minute's time, two types of memory in your computer, your hard disk and RAM. So your hard disk, you mind if I draw a little picture here before we segue to the dissection?
No, keep talking.
Okay. So you have your hard disk, which can be abbreviated any number of ways. HDD, hard disk drive, is a pretty common one. That is your platters, the magnetic particles inside of this storing gigabytes or even terabytes of information. All of your programs go here, your music, your movies, anything that you want to persist even when the cord is pulled out and the power is off. So that's good, because those magnetic particles stay where you left them. Now, when you double-click an icon on your desktop, like Microsoft Word, those bits essentially get loaded into another type of memory called RAM, or random access memory. Whereas your hard disk might be something like, and I'm going to come up with popular but arbitrary numbers, 500 gigabytes, GB is the abbreviation for that. RAM these days is maybe what? 2, 3, 4, and that's actually kind of on the high end, or at least if you've most recently bought a computer, but sure, let's say 2 gigabytes of RAM. But lest I get reprimanded, I won't brag how much RAM my computer has. But 2 gigabytes, but it's an order of magnitude difference, right? So we have, you know, more digits here than here, but that's interesting because, well, that's the reason for that is twofold. One, this RAM, this memory is much faster, which means you actually don't need as much of it, and it's not storing things forever. It just needs to store information temporarily, but it's also much more expensive. per unit of bytes. So what does that mean? You double click Microsoft Word or whatever program, it gets loaded from your hard disk where it lives permanently, temporarily into RAM where it can run much more quickly, and then finally is it fed piece by piece into the so-called brains of your computer, the CPU. Now a CPU operates not in terms of bytes so much as it does in terms of cycles. So the unit of measure here is typically something like, what, let's say 2 gigahertz, GH little z. So a hertz, you might remember from high school physics, it's just one something per second. So 1 hertz is 1 something per second. 1 gigahertz is 1 billion things per second. 2 gigahertz is 2 billion things per second. Now what does that mean? Well, inside of most CPUs is essentially a little crystal that oscillates ever so quickly. So kind of twitching back and forth, and each of those is a clock cycle. You can think of it as a snap of the finger. And every time my finger snaps, or every time the CPU indulges in a cycle, it can do something. What something? Can read a memory from, it can read a number from RAM. It can do addition, it can do a subtraction, it can multiply two numbers, it can do any number of very basic things from which all of the complexity of today's computers arise, but my fingers should be snapping 2 billion times per second. So the more times I can snap per second, the more things your computer can do at once, and thus the faster it typically appears to run. But this is the pipeline of sorts from your permanent storage of data. It goes here so you can access it more quickly, and then it goes here to actually be analyzed and executed by the CPU. And I said a moment ago, it's a bit of a white lie, because there are often two middlemen here, and this is the last of our picture. Sorry for not warning you if you didn't leave enough space on your piece of paper. You have what's called L2 cache and L1 cache, level 2, level 1. And these are similar in spirit to RAM, but they're even faster. They are closer to the CPU conceptually, but they're present in even smaller quantities. So you have from left to right, smaller, 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 but faster, 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 but also pricier, 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 pricier. And that's how you essentially funnel information constantly to your CPU, so you're always keeping coal in the fire, so to speak, because you're shoving as much toward it as fast as you can at the very end of this pipeline. So shall we take a tour and see what we can't see?
Sure. So you can usually see almost all of these devices physically in your machine. And in fact, you can almost always upgrade each of them individually as well. Now, there are some exceptions. Sometimes your computers, you just cannot open them up because you avoid the warranty or some variety like that. So if you're in doubt, take your neighbor's computer and try to open it up. So you find a way to open up the case, and there's always a different way depending on the manufacturer and the generation of the computer itself. And you get something that looks kind of like this, but hopefully a little bit less fuzzy.
And let me qualify, if you do try this at home, there is nothing more embarrassing than not being able to open a computer's case. And especially if you consider yourself a technical person, show up on site to help a friend with their computer, you can't even figure out how to open the damn thing. Mm-hmm. This is not an uncommon occurrence. So
this is precisely why I just had the case laying right there. I didn't want to have to be futzing with it and everybody saying, oh, why can't you open the computer? So anyway, here we go. So what you can see now at the bottom is the what? Motherboard, right. And so as you might have seen from the picture, they do actually come in different colors as well. So don't be surprised if yours isn't green. That doesn't mean it's some sort of magical color that makes it faster. They just have different colors of motherboards that exist. And connected to this are a bunch of cables and some green plastic things and just a variety of things. And usually in a desktop computer, you can very, very easily remove some of these. But if you're going to do this, I recommend a couple of things. If you're going to actually open up your computer, please, please, please unplug it from your wall. If you do not, you will injure yourself or your computer, and I don't want either one happening. So after you unplug it, not only the power, but also all of the cables from the back, and this is actually a really good exercise because we will be talking about the ports that are found on the back of your computer as well, but it is satisfying to be able to disconnect everything and try to figure out where everything goes or what everything actually is and what it actually does. So this is actually a pretty interesting and useful thing. Unfortunately, though, I think a lot of us nowadays have laptops rather than desktops. A few years ago, many of us still had desktops, and this was something that was possible. It's a lot harder to open up a laptop, and I don't really recommend trying that. You have lots of screws, and it can be quite a pain. But anyway, generally what you have in here are some power cords and some data cords, and if you can keep them straight, if you can somehow label them or make a mental note of them, but if you make a mental note of them, be careful because they tend to shift around and you can get confused about which is where, then you can pretty easily figure out what devices are in your computer. So you'll notice that this motherboard is actually separated into two. So not only do we have the board at the very bottom here, but also we have a board that's sort of at a right angle. So you see this is the bottom that we were looking at before, and now at the bottom, what is the actual bottom of the computer, we see a base where we have just some white slots. And on the motherboards that you have coming around right now, you might actually be able to get a better look at some of these white slots. And these white slots are known as just expansion slots. You will be able to plug in additional expansion cards into them to enable additional functionality to your computer. So for example, you might, especially if you have an older computer, maybe you need to add a modem, or maybe you want to replace a video card, maybe you want to add a sound card, maybe you want to add another video card. There's a variety of things that you can add to your computer or replace in your computer just based on these cards. And in fact, it looks like what we have right here is just a simple audio card. And the way that you can tell is, well, not only do I have a cheat sheet in the back, and I can see that there's basically some headphone ports in the back, but also there's a cable. And a lot of these cables end up looking pretty similar after a while, and you don't have to remember this, but just this one particular cable happens to look like an audio cable. But this actually brings up an interesting question. Why on earth might we have an audio cable inside of the computer? Presumably, if we're playing music, it will be able to go through the motherboard and then through the actual expansion port itself to play in your headphones or on your speakers. So why on earth would we have an audio cable on the inside of the computer?
Coming from the optical drive,
exactly. So especially back in the day before we had DVDs or we had CD drives, and usually what a lot of people would do is they would put a CD into their CD drive and listen to the music on their computer, and this audio cable does exactly that. The CD drive is actually responsible for playing the song, and it would just channel the audio very much like a CD player that you might have at home. It would just channel the audio through this cable and into the sound card that would accept the sound and then just replay it, basically, through your headphones or through your speakers. But moving on, you'll notice that we have a few other things in here as well. We have some cables that look like this. And these cables are data cables. They bring data to and from other peripheral devices that are elsewhere in the computer. And in fact, if I try to follow this one cable, I'm trying to do it. I know it's a little bit jittery, but I'm trying to follow the cable. You might be able to see it's connected to something. What does that look like over here? Yep, that is a hard drive. So it's just a hard drive that has been, this is just a hard drive that has been removed from the computer. But you'll notice that at the end of this hard drive, there's a connector where that one cable would be able to fit very, very nicely. Now, unfortunately, this is something that's called an ATA or an IDE cable. The terms are used pretty much interchangeably, and this is, unfortunately, a slightly older version of what you might find in a modern computer. Modern cables to hard drives are a bit smaller, and they are what are called SATA, S-A-T-A, or serial ATA cables, and they are considerably smaller. As you know, technology, as it matures, it gets smaller, it gets faster, and that's the general trend. So usually newer computers will also have smaller cables inside, smaller connectors inside. Unfortunately, I don't think we have a SATA connector to be able to show you this time. I'm not sure we will next time either. Okay, so moving on from there, you'll notice that we do have a couple of extra peripherals in here. We have the hard drive right here, which we just saw was connected via the IDE cable to the motherboard. So what's this other cable right here?
Power,
exactly. So pretty much every device that you have inside of your computer needs a data connection and a power connection. Sometimes you might have more, and if you have fewer, that usually means that you're channeling one of those two things through some other means, or it's not connected properly and you should redo the connection. But then also up here we have a device that's, in this case, I'm not sure if it's a CD or a DVD drive, but it's one of the two. And we have also connected to this another IDE cable and another power cable. So we could actually disconnect this and reconnect it if you wanted, but there's not much point in it here. And as you can tell from this layout, a lot of these things are upgradable. And this is one of the good things about having a desktop computer versus a laptop. If something happens to fail, then you might be able to just replace that one specific object or that one specific peripheral if you can figure out what it is. And in fact, I have a desktop at home that I use, and just literally last Wednesday, I blamed David. He came over for the first time in a long time, and he was looking around my apartment because I recently moved. Oh, yeah, that's nice. Looked at my computer. Uh-huh. Okay, that's decent. And I swear he did something, because when he left, all of a sudden, I just got all these weird sort of wavy lines on my computer screen. I was trying to figure out what was going on. And soon, I couldn't even turn on my computer. Every time I would turn it on, I would just get these pink and gray and cyan and all sorts of crazy colors on the screen. And I was so annoyed, because it was right before classes started and I needed my computer to be able to work on things. But luckily, it's just by deduction, I was able to figure out that the video card had failed. Ordered a replacement video card, it came in, popped it out of one of the expansion slots, put in the new one, and it's back up and running. And so, luckily, this isn't meant to be like, oh yeah, I'm so awesome sort of thing, but just a mention of what is certainly possible. And this was something that, you know, I spent much less on to purchase a new peripheral, a new video card, rather than having to spend another few thousand dollars on replacing this entirely good, otherwise entirely good computer. Okay, so moving on. We can get to some of the perhaps more interesting things, some of the things that you might not have seen before. So we have, in this case, this green plastic doohickey right here. What might this thing do? It itself is not a fan, but it channels the air. And so all it does after you remove it is you realize that it's just meant to channel, just to funnel some air. And you'll notice that where it was connected before was right here, and this actually is a fan, and this is used to cool the CPU. The CPU being the sort of the central area where all of this data gets piped through in your computer gets extremely, extremely hot, and so we have to be able to cool it off. And one of the ways that we do this is through the use of moving air, so fans, and also something called a heatsink. And the heatsink that is almost always makes up the bulk, all of the bulk in your CPU, is usually found on top and is usually something like this, which is metal, and it has a lot of fins, a lot of very thin pieces of metal sort of sticking out from it, and the entire point is to distribute the heat from this very small processor into a very large surface area. So in other words, it's just distributing the heat into something that can then be cooled very easily by a fan or by moving air. Sometimes fancy computers might do away with a fan and with a heatsink and might use like liquid cooling or something like that, but I'm not convinced that that's necessarily better than just using the tried and true method. I mean, if you spill liquid inside of your computer, that's going to be a problem. So that's something that you want to watch out for. Now, I'm not completely sure I'll be able to remove this heatsink, but underneath the heatsink that's right here is the actual CPU. Let's see. Well, that's broken. Not like it worked anyway. Well, I might have to try this a little bit later because
Dan makes house calls too, if you'd like.
Yeah, I'm pricey though, so. All right, well, anyway, that's stuck in there pretty well.
But were he able to remove it, you would see that.
Well, that looks a lot fancier than what I would show you, because usually if you actually open up your computer, I don't recommend getting to the point where you move the heatsink, because there's a material that exists between the heatsink and the processor itself that helps transfer the heat, and this would be very, very bad for you to mess up. Every time you remove the heatsink from the CPU, you actually have to go through this process of replacing this material. It's just a big thing, so don't bother doing that until you know what you're doing. But anyway, the CPU does look something like this. And what do you notice about this particular CPU? So what characteristic is sort of unusual about this? Spiky. Yeah, exactly. And what might be the reason for these spikes? I'm sorry? I'm sorry? They're channels, yes. So they're channels, so they supply power, data to and from the motherboard and the CPU. So the central part of this entire device that collectively we call the CPU,
the majority, in a lot of modern CPUs, the vast majority of the area taken up by it, even though this is blown up a considerable portion. This is actually a lot bigger than what we would actually see in the device that exists in here. The vast majority of the area is actually taken up by all of the connectors that are necessary between the CPU and the motherboard itself. And on the motherboard that you the motherboards that are going around, you'll actually notice like a slot, a square slot with sort of a hole in the middle, almost like a square donut. That is where this CPU goes. That's a bad representation. All right, so and it has tiny, tiny little holes where all of those connectors go, and the CPU fits in very, very well. It's used to, and all of these slots are used just to pipe data back and forth from the CPU.
And we'll talk more about this next week, too, when we take things up a level and talk about, you know, what details, what numbers should you yourself as a consumer care about when buying a computer. But the CPU is one of those things that, even though, as Dan hinted, you can remove it and you can upgrade it, this is not a typical scenario, certainly not for normal people or even people like us, because at the point when you get to the point where your computer is that old and that slow, the reality is there are many other parts in your computer that are also, by nature of the technological advances, slow also. So even though, yes, you could swap in a slightly faster CPU, odds are when it's time to upgrade your CPU, it's time to get another computer. But by contrast, as is the scenario I'm currently going through, you know, my Mac Pro, which is a desktop but made by Apple that looks a little something like this, you know, I actually am just out of disk space. The thing is plenty fast. It's going to take me for another couple of years, certainly, but I need more disk space. And so a number of the explorations Dan's doing here are actually very germane, even to a, you know, typical user who might just want to add hard disks to their computer or subtract and then upgrade drives.
It is actually very interesting, because usually you buy a computer and it has a certain amount of CPU, but usually what happens is that you run out of disk space first. And you'll notice that, especially in this computer, we do have empty slots where we could put additional peripherals, like an additional hard drive or another CD-ROM or DVD-ROM drive, if that's what you find out that you need. Now, something that is interesting that I should point out on this motherboard as well is this little circular thing right here. So it looks slightly different than all of the other things on the motherboard. What might this be?
Battery.
Yeah, the battery. And what is it used for? I'm sorry?
Power to the motherboard.
So power for what, though? Because it's certainly not enough to power all of the devices that you see in the screen. Right, so it's what keeps the time in your computer between when you shut it off and you disconnect it and when you plug it back in and turn it back on. So it's very much just a watch battery, and you can think of it like a watch that's built into your computer, and it's what remembers the time. If you ever turn on your computer, you get error messages that the time is messed up, or it says it's the year 2000 or year 1970 something if you have an older computer, and you say, oh, well, it's time to get a new computer, don't bother. You can usually replace a $2 or $3 battery inside of the computer and get another few years of service out of that particular machine, especially if that's the only thing wrong with that computer. Now, some of the other things on here that you'll notice, so we don't need to talk about some of these specific chips, though there are some larger chips that actually are interesting in terms of the motherboard, but a lot of these are uninteresting to us. What is interesting, though, are some of the other slots that exist here. So you might see that directly or nearby the CPU, we have, if I move some of this, some slots over here that are made for RAM. You'll notice that it's very easy in just about every computer to actually remove the RAM, and you have additional slots where you can put in more RAM. You can remove old RAM, put in new RAM if that ends up failing. And usually it looks something like this. So it just has a bunch of chips on it. It's like a mini motherboard. It's not that exactly, but you know, it's printed on a circuit board and has some chips on it with connectors along the bottom. And RAM, though, can take different shapes and sizes, especially if we are talking about laptop memory versus desktop memory. So here's some other RAM, for example. It really depends, and this should hint to you, at least, that if you decide that your computer doesn't have enough RAM, that you need to upgrade the RAM in it, that you need to figure out exactly what type of RAM you need in order to actually perform this specific upgrade in your computer. And generally, upgrading the RAM is, if it's possible in your computer, the easiest thing to do of all of the upgrades that are available to you for your computer. So before you decide that you need to throw away this computer, if you do determine that one of the causes of the slowdown is this lack of RAM, and it's something that we'll talk about later when we talk about this concept of virtual memory and paging and some of these other terms, then you might decide to just upgrade the RAM and get even more time out of your computer. Yes?
Is it all right to touch them like that, or are you just showing
us on? No, if you're upgrading it, you shouldn't touch it like this. Generally, what's proper, and the reason I'm being careless here is just because I know this computer doesn't work, and if it didn't before, it certainly doesn't now between my fiddling and the rain and just everything. But basically, what's generally proper is that if you're going to do some work on your computer, you shouldn't be on carpet, first of all. You should be on a hardwood floor. You should ground yourself by actually touching a metal portion of the computer, and then you touch all of the components by corners or by edges. None of the contacts. Never ever touch the contacts, because the oil from your fingers might smudge and you might get a small electrical connection between some of the contacts. You might short it out, or it might just break or something like that. And generally, just holding it by the edges is a good thing to do. If you have problems with that, then just try to get touch the areas that have the fewest number of traces. So if you look very, very closely on all of these circuits, it almost looks like a miniature city. Let's see. I think I have. No. All right. You can sort of see it here. If I zoom in a little bit, you can sort of see what I'm talking about is, for example, between this battery and this chip on the left side, you can sort of see these little almost streets that are running between various things. If you can find on the printed circuit board the area with the fewest number of those, what are called traces, or of all of these other devices that are on it, generally it's safe to hold that portion as well. So it's usually something like a corner or something like that. And so don't be careless like I am and just touch the RAM anywhere you want, because that's generally going to be a bad thing.
Do you mind if I pull this up?
Sure.
And just so this isn't too arcane, so upgrading RAM and disks is pretty common. And to be honest, almost any computer you open looks a little different from the last one. And what you should appreciate as these motherboards are going around is that a lot of upgrades that are user done are pretty self-explanatory, or it's something you can certainly infer just by looking at it. And the two lucky ones who still have the motherboards in your hands, you'll see that there's two little plastic clips where the RAM is supposed to go. There's these little slots that look a little something like, let's see if I can pull this back up here. There are slots into which these things here would fit. You just kind of push down on those levers. The RAM that's currently in your computer will generally pop up. If it doesn't, you just grab it, as Dan described, and pull it straight out, put it aside on something that's not carpet, for instance, and then figure out how to orient the other one and simply put it back. So these are the slots to which we're alluding here. And the little switches on the end, one of which Dan kind of broke off earlier, all a different piece, but same idea. It's pretty much two steps. Open, push in, and they should automatically close. Now, how to find more RAM for your computer, just so we can make this a little real world here. So honestly, I never read the manuals to my own computer, and I can rarely find the manuals online to my own computer, so I typically turn to any number of helpful websites, two of which we thought we'd cite here. So I just pulled up, while Dan prepped there, this site, crucial.com. This is actually a company that makes computer equipment and sells RAM. They actually tend to be on the pricey side, but they have a wonderful tool that tells you what kind of RAM is or should be inside of your computer. So just as an example here, I will pull up, let's say, Apple. And the computer I recently upgraded was a Mac Pro. So I'm going to choose my Mac Pro here. And they have Dell, IBM, HP, any number of brands, certainly the popular ones. And now I think I have this model here, so I'm going to click Find It. And what you'll get is some esoteric information, but some useful information. So at top left, one, without having to take the cover off, I can see how many of those slots that Dan just showed I actually have inside of my computer. I'll see some footnotes that can tell me what can go inside of each of those slots. Some computers, especially older computers, you actually need to add two RAM chips at a time. You can't just do one. But it will vary based on system. Apparently, my system holds DDR2 PC2 6400 memory and a maximum of 4,096 megabytes per slot. Oh, 4 gigabytes per slot. 4,000 megabytes would be 4 gigabytes. So you get familiar with terms like that. And then I can actually buy it from these guys if I want. But you see that sometimes, especially for Macs, frankly, the prices tend to get a little high. But this is much, much lower than yesteryear. Another really good source for stuff like this, and we'll start maintaining on the course's website some popular links, DealRAM, which really does, as the name says. Their configuration tool tends not to be as current as Crucial's. But if I do something like Dell here, and then I have to choose my system. Let's see, I have a Dell Precision, let's say, what do I have? I have a T3400. Let me click this. I will get similar links, but sort of a price comparison approach. And you can click different tabs to figure out different amounts. But this site is not as informative as to what kind of RAM and how much of it I can put into my computer. But frankly, between these two sites and then Google and Amazon, I usually find what I'm looking for.
Now, we're not telling you all of this to make you feel like you have to open up your computer and you have to be and you have to upgrade any of these devices. We're just trying to show this to you, especially, I mean, that this is the first lecture, that it's not that hard. You shouldn't be that scared of the inside of your computer. It may look a little bit daunting, but you can break it down, and having a little bit of knowledge about how these things work, you'll be able to find out what pieces do what, and you'll be able to determine what is your RAM. And if you want, then you can proceed along this path that we're describing in upgrading the RAM or the hard drive. But certainly this is something that you might consider rather than purchasing an entirely new computer. If you decide that it's not just the computer as a whole that's not working well for you, but it's some particular component, you can go ahead and upgrade just that one specific component.
But it's worth taking a step back as to why, or the who cares. Like, why upgrade? Why might your computer no longer be up to snuff? Well, odds are you can infer from today's discussion, you know, why you might want more disk space. Give me one reason. More stuff, more files, more videos, more music. You just have more needs that naturally grow over time. But RAM is a little less obvious. Like, why might you want more of RAM, which is apparently sits in between, conceptually, the hard drive and your CPU? So speed in what sense, though? Because it's the CPU that really determines your computer's speed, yeah? Yeah, you can run more programs at the same time. So this is an interesting experiment, one that you might have accidentally conducted over time. If you double-click Microsoft Word and AOL Instant Messenger and Internet Explorer and 6 other programs, you'll notice that they'll probably all launch, and you'll get all your little icons in your system tray or wherever. But the machine will start to do what? Will start to slow down. And in fact, the more and more programs you run, they might still open. Eventually, the operating system might say, too many. But for the most part, they'll still open. But your machine does start to feel like it's grinding to a halt. And in fact, sometimes when you quit those programs, it doesn't necessarily rectify the situation if you haven't quite opened or closed them in a certain order. Now, well, long story short, and we'll tease this apart a little more next week, as Dan alluded, with virtual memory, when your computer runs out of physical RAM, in other words, when you've clicked so many icons that you just can't fit all of those programs in RAM simultaneously, your computer starts to cheat and tries to hide this detail from you. It starts to put your programs back onto your hard disk, calling it virtual memory, because it's not really memory. It's not really RAM. It's virtual. But it doesn't tell you about it. But it puts it there so that it can make room for the most recent program you clicked. So if you're the type who's constantly switching between programs or hitting Alt-Tab or the equivalent a lot, and sometimes it's like so painfully slow before the background window becomes the foreground or the other one gets minimized, it's usually because there's all of this communication going on unbeknownst to you between RAM and hard disk while your computer is desperately trying to keep up with your needs. So you can make your computer faster by adding RAM sometimes if the problem you're having is that you're trying to use more programs at once simultaneously, or if you're a photo file and like to edit photographs and therefore have Adobe Photoshop, a really popular program that itself would love to use up 1 gigabyte, 2 gigabytes, 4 gigabytes of RAM just for itself. Well, you might be able to run one program, if that, depending on the type of program too. So there is one at-home exercise we can be quite comfortable in assigning you, in addition to assignment one, and that's a little something involving this thing, this picture here. So all of you presumably have a computer or have access to a computer, and a valuable at-home exercise will be this. And out of 100 students, I worry that there will be some number of malfunctioning computers next Monday, but we'll go with the odds and challenge you to look behind your computer or that of a colleague or friend and pull all of the cables out from the back of the computer. So it might sound simple, but frankly, we know there's a demographic in this class and others like it where this is actually kind of a scary task, putting them back. Pulling them out, pretty easy. Putting them back, not so nice. But the upside of a computer like this, as you can see from this little pictorial here, is that what has Dell done for your benefit? So they're actually color-coded. And so even, I have this discussion with family members who I'm no longer allowed to cite specifically on video that find this task daunting to just reconnect things. I have to go all the way home sometimes to reconnect the mouse or the keyboard. And yet, that's fine, right? We're family, so I have to do it. But honestly, there's enough different connectors out there these days, and frankly, they're color-coded, and frankly, you can't really do much damage if you're gentle enough and that you use some common sense and realize, oh, like, square does not go into circular hole. You're not gonna do that much damage, even keeping the case closed. So what we thought we'd do in conclusion tonight is look at some of the more user serviceable parts so that you at least know what you're plugging in here. So, can't really do this as a verbal exercise because there's a cheat sheet up here on the board. But let's block off maybe a couple, let's do it by way of what you might connect to these things and have a short running list here of the types of things you yourself might be connecting to your own computer. So I used one acronym earlier to describe this camera. That camera that we got is connected to Dan's laptop via what type of connector or port, if you can. So USB. So USB has taken a few years to really catch on, but now, my God, almost anything can be connected to your computer via USB. There's several different versions of it, USB 1, USB 2, and they're different speeds, but for the most part, users only care that they buy a USB device and they have a USB slot or connector on their computer so that they can connect it. Almost any modern computer these days has at least one USB slot. Even my desktop at home has like 6 or 8, so it's really gotten to the point of wonderfully excessive. But what kinds of devices can you connect to a USB port? Well, a camera like this or your own digital camera. What else might get connected to a USB port? A printer is pretty common. Mice also get connected these days. Or there are wireless mice, which use another another technology. But what else? OK, so a flash drive. So a flash drive, and we'll talk more about this next week, is a type of hard drive, but it doesn't have moving parts and spinning magnetic platters. I heard something else.
iPod?
Yes, perfect. So iPods, iPhones, other devices like that. An external hard drive, I'll just call this something a little different here. Other things come to mind?
BlackBerry.
Yeah, BlackBerries too. So any kind of iPod, and I'll just say phone, dot, 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 to describe any number of things.
Wireless.
So wireless, like a wireless card?
Wireless mouse.
Right? So wireless mouse wouldn't need to go through USB necessarily. It probably uses something called Bluetooth, these days at least. But there are, older ones do have a sender and receiver that uses USB.
Yeah.
Universal serial bus. And actually, that's a good piece of jargon just to get out of the way. So a bus is a general nomenclature for some kind of pathway between points A and B. You see it all throughout computing. So universal serial bus is kind of saying, you can put almost anything on this pathway, all of these various devices. All right, anyone want to pluck off any of the other numbered items from the cheat sheet here that you might connect something familiar?
The keyboard connector.
Yeah, so the very good. Keyboard connector gets the keyboard. So the thing that's in green and in blue, green and purple, Mac users don't have these slots, but these are called PS2 connectors. They're actually falling rather into disuse these days, but historically it was for your keyboard and mouse, keyboard being purple, mouse being green. But typically you're seeing, oh, we forgot to put keyboard over here. Typically, you're seeing these being replaced by USB devices, but this is a PCs up here. Top right, number 5, is called network adapter connector. So you can infer, too, what goes there. This is where your so-called Ethernet cable goes. And we'll talk more about this in our lectures on networking and the internet. USB serial. Some of these have fallen into disuse. So the thing at the top left, parallel connector, pretty much out of vogue these days. The serial connector at bottom left, pretty much out of vogue these days. But number 9 is actually surprisingly modern on this thing. eSATA is a connector for fast external hard drives. So there are other types of connectors for external drives. For the most part, and we don't mean this as a diminutive, normal people are typically fine with getting, for instance, a modern USB drive. But if you're into video production or you really need to transfer lots of data quickly, then a lot of these other acronyms will come into play. And we'll tease some of them apart over time, depending on the application and context.
It's interesting to make the connection back to the connectors that we were talking about inside the computer, how we were talking about ATA for hard drives, and then the newer, more modern version is serial ATA, or SATA. And this is just, it's the same connector, but it's an external version of the same thing.
So we thought we would tease you with what's ahead next week. So next week we continue our look at computer hardware. By that we're going to take a step slightly higher level than today. Today was very low level, zeros and ones CPUs. Next week we'll focus more on the consumerism of things, the kind of numbers you really should care about, the kinds of price tags and labels you'd see in a magazine or a store. But we'll also take a look at some of the larger pieces of equipment, among them those actual hard drives. So let's take a look at this one teaser. And roll for it.
The hard drive is where your PC stores most of its permanent data. To do that, the data travels from RAM along with software signals that tell the hard drive how to store that data. The hard drive circuits translate those signals into voltage fluctuations. These, in turn, control the hard drive's moving parts, some of the few moving parts left in the modern computer. Some of the signals control a motor which spins metal-coated platters. Their data is actually stored on these platters. Other signals move the read-write heads to read or write data on the platters. This machinery is so precise that a human hair couldn't even pass between the heads and spinning platters. Yet, it all works at terrific speeds.
Unless things have gotten a little too intense, we do like to show this one other video just to put everything into context. Why don't we go with this one here?
This is the on-off switch. On some computers, it may be found on the back or side. If you use this switch to reboot your computer, you should wait 10 seconds after turning it off before you turn it on again. This will help your PC keep everything clear.
All right, so now we have leveled the playing field. The homework assignment, which is due next Monday at 5:30 p.m., can be found on the homepage of computerscience1.net. Dan and I will stick around for a while with any questions. Otherwise, we hope to see you again next week.